So, have you heard the story of the four ministers who used to meet on a regular basis? And one day at one of their meetings, one of them said, "You know, a lot of our congregants come to us and share their deepest, darkest, most secret sins with us, and then they feel a release after they've shared. Maybe we should do the same thing with one another." Well, after a while, they agreed. So the first minister said, "Well, you know, I have a confession to make. I have a terrible temper, and I have a really hard time controlling it. I've even been known to throw my wife's most precious crystal glasses against the wall and break them." And the second minister said, "Well, you know, after service, if I have a really good lesson, a really good sermon, I like to go home and kick up my feet and smoke a few cigars and have more than one glass of my favorite port." And the third minister said, "Well, you know, I love golf more than anything on this planet, and I have been known to call in sick to get in a few rounds." I think that might have some meaning to some people in this room, but we won't go there. But the fourth minister didn't want to share at that point. And they said, "Well, now, come on, we've shared our most secret sins. This is not fair. You need to share yours." He said, "Okay, but I have to tell you, I am an incurable gossip, and I can't wait to get out of this room." Well, the concept of sin has always been a central factor in religion from the beginning of time. And Eric Butterworth, in his book, Discover the Power Within You, says, "It is unfortunate that we accept words like sin as absolutes without even stopping to think about what they might mean." And he says, "Sin occurs when we are out of harmony with the source of our being. In other words, sin is a sense of separation from God." Now note that we say a sense of, because truly we can never be separated from God except in our own consciousness. In other words, if God seems far away, guess who moved? Butterworth says, when we are unaware of our divinity, our spiritual essence, then we just act from the level of our humanity. When we don't know our innate goodness, we do a lot of things that might be called evil. And the word evil also needs definition, or I should say redefinition. Charles Fillmore said that evil is error thinking, when we just are thinking wrongly. And Butterworth says evil is simply concealment of the good. We need to think of all evil or sin as the apparent absence of good, in the same way that darkness is the absence of light. The presence of darkness does not mean that there is no light. It simply means that it is temporarily hidden from our view. Butterworth uses the analogy of God being like a light bulb. And when the light is turned on, it shines brightly, just as when we radiate our divinity, we make that connection with the God presence within. However, when we turn the light off, we break the connection, and we experience darkness. In the same way, breaking the spiritual connection within causes darkness in our minds and our thinking. The light is still light, and God is still God. The only change is in our awareness of them. So any evil condition in this world is really the result of people just dwelling in the darkness of human consciousness. And in this consciousness, and some of us might have felt this sometimes, in this consciousness, people see themselves as separate, alone, limited. And when people are feeling that way, sometimes they're willing to hurt others to promote themselves. Now, it doesn't mean that the activity of God is missing in those people, because we know the activity of God is always within each one of us. It simply means they're not aware of the presence of God within, so they don't draw on this unlimited love and light that is really there. Life for them is a jungle, chaotic and unpredictable. Here's a father saying to his newborn, How do you want to play this? Asking, I should say. How do you want to play this? Nature or nurture or a little bit of both? And Butterworth says, it is not human nature that is at the fault of our evil experiences, but it's human nurture. In other words, those who engage in acts we call evil dwell in the darkness of self-limitation. They feel like they're personally limited. And no one is born with negative attitudes, no one. Whenever we see a limitation of any kind, even expressed in the most horrific deeds, we can be sure that someone taught that child. Some of you might remember the six powerful words titling a song from South Pacific, "You've Got to Be Carefully Taught." I'll do you a big favor and not sing them, but I'm going to read them to you. You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes seem oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. And maybe this is why Jesus insists that we must become as little children. We must return to that state of purity that we had before we began to absorb and nurture all the error beliefs of our culture. As Nelson Mandela said, "Love comes naturally, but hate is learned." And most of us were also exposed to some error thoughts about God. Butterworth says, it is more than likely that you were raised on the teaching of a distant God up in the skies, sitting on a throne, recording in his, and yes, God was always male, in his black book, all of your sins, and planning your punishment accordingly. Now, when we hold this image of God, he says, you live and worship in the fear of God's wrath, the mighty fist of God. You prayed and pledged and participated because you were afraid not to. And the gates of hell yawned wide for you if you fell down on any of your religious responsibilities. I found this excerpt from a Puritan minister, 16th century Jonathan Edwards, and he writes, "The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as worthy of nothing else but to be cast in that fire for eternity." Aren't you glad you came to church today? I mean, the uplifting news, of course, is that this is definitely not what Jesus taught, not at all. We know that Jesus taught God is love, and we are all one in that love. Butterworth says all through the Gospels, there runs the implication that you are not punished so much for your sins as by them. As many of you know, sin is an archery term that simply means missing the mark. And sin is really our failure to hit the target of God's perfection. The result is a sense of separation from God, from good. And the punishment is that we have cut ourselves off from the source. God never cuts us off, but we can cut ourselves off, leading to lack and limitation. Eric Butterworth's famous acronym for sin, I know many of you know, what is it? Self-inflicted nonsense. That's what he calls it, self-inflicted nonsense. There was a story about a priest in the Philippines who carried a secret sin that he had committed many, many years ago. And in his congregation, there was one woman who proclaimed to have regular visions of God and regular conversations with God. Maybe she should have beat Walsh to the punch and written that book, right? Conversations with God. But at any rate, the minister didn't believe her. He was very skeptical of this. And so he said to her one day, next time you have your conversation with God, would you ask him something? Would you ask him what your priest's sin was, main sin was, back in Bible college? And she said, sure, I will ask him. So a week went by, and he ran into the woman again, and he said, okay, did you talk to God this week? And she said, sure did. And he said to her, well, what did God say about my sin? And she said, well, you know, it's really strange. God said he doesn't know and he doesn't remember your sin. Now, maybe Maybe that one little story can teach us more about forgiveness and God than all of the combined doctrine in the world. Because God is love. And one of the Bible prophets, Habakkuk, says, he's a minor prophet, that's why we've probably never heard of him. He said, God's eyes are too pure to behold evil. God's eyes are too pure to behold evil. And this is really vital to our understanding. God, and this is really different for us to understand, God knows nothing of sin. Butterworth says, this may surprise you, it may disturb you, it may even seem sacrilegious to you. But I think the reason it's so hard for us to accept that is we carry this deeply embedded carryover of that idea of God who sits up there judging us from the sky, rejoicing in our progress and becoming angry over our weaknesses. When we expand our vision to contemplate God of universal mind, God as pure good, as loving principle, as sustaining spirit, then we understand that God only sees the divinity within us, whether we are expressing it at the moment or not. Light doesn't know darkness, light is. God doesn't know evil, God is. God is only omnipresent good. And Butterworth says, in typical Butterworth form, can light stop being light? Does gravity stop being gravity? Can God stop being love? In Jeremiah, we read, behold, I have loved you with an everlasting love. God's love is as omniactive as gravity, and God does not hold less than love for us, no matter what. God is love, even if I am filled with anger or hatred. God is love always. The moment I can release my bitterness, rise above my guilt, and stop feeling sorry for myself, at that moment, I allow that love of God to sweep over me, and then I am forgiven. Now, Butterworth cites the familiar story of the prodigal son as exemplifying the unconditional love of God. And I know we've heard this story so many times, and it can be interpreted a million different ways. We were talking about this at class the other night. You all know it. It's about a son who wanders off into the far country, squanders his inheritance on loose living, returns destitute to his father. And Butterworth says that the father represents the divinity in us, and the son represents the human side of us, who forgets his divinity and therefore experiences a sense of separation and ultimate lack. When the son leaves the far country of human consciousness and comes to himself, and those are exact words in almost all of the versions, the son comes to himself, he awakens to his divinity and returns to that state of oneness with his father. And what is the father's reaction? What is the father's reaction? Got ahead of myself a little bit. There he is. Well, what would your reaction be? Would it be something like, where have you been? What have you done? What were you thinking? Don't you realize you brought this all on yourself? Some of those typical parental comments. Some of us in this room have been known to have those things come fly out of our mouths before we knew what was going on. But this father asked no questions. Absolutely none. He makes no accusations, he demands no apology, and he imposes no punishment. He simply rejoices and showers his son with gifts, saying, "My son who was dead is now alive again." The human consciousness, in other words, has returned to its true nature, and there is only joy and celebration. Now, Butterworth says a personal lesson from this story is the moment I see myself in a higher context, I have overcome or come over the basic sin. Anybody want to guess what the basic sin is? What would you think? The whole theme of Butterworth's book. The basic sin is forgetting my own divinity, forgetting who I really am. And that basic sin results in all sort of secondary sins. But the moment I realized the truth of my innate divinity, my divine essence, in that moment, I flip the switch and turn on the light. And I let the flood of life and inspiration and intelligence fill me and thrill me, and I am transformed. In that moment, I am forgiven because I have claimed my true identity and I see myself as God sees me. Now, Jesus spoke many times about forgiveness. He connected it to prayer, to prosperity, and to healing. And one of the verses that has been really misinterpreted, according to Butterworth, is Matthew 6:14-15, where Jesus says, "For if you forgive others their trespasses, your heavenly Father will forgive you. But if you do not forgive others, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses." I remember that verse very well from a kid in Sunday school. And Butterworth says, this is not saying that God is arbitrary or withholding forgiveness. This is just a personalized way of talking about divine principle. It's really hard for our human heads to understand God as principle. And so God is often clothed in human form in the teachings of the prophets in the Old Testament and sometimes even by Jesus to help people understand the symbol of Father. And unfortunately, 2,000 years later, many of us have gotten trapped in this singular concept of God as judge in the skies. So what this verse really means is God is love, and we can only open our hearts to that love when we too are acting in love. If we want forgiveness, we must express forgiveness. There is no other way. An insight into Jesus' thinking on this subject is found in Matthew 18:21-22, where Peter says to Matthew, comes to Matthew and says, "Lord, how often should I forgive someone who sins against me? 7 times? And Jesus replies, "No, not 7 times, but 70 times 7. Now, to understand Jesus' response to Peter, we need to look a little bit at the historical context. Rabbis at the time taught that 3 times was the limit for human forgiveness. I wonder if that's the source of that law, 3 strikes and you're out. I don't know. Could be. The teaching that humans were not allowed to forgive 4 times was actually based on an Old Testament belief that divine forgiveness was limited to 4 times, and a man could not forgive more than God. One Bible scholar says Peter must have taken the rabbi's commandment, doubled it, and added 1 for good measure. Surely that was enough. And maybe you share this reaction. I think I do. Great. Not only do I have to forgive my brother, now I have to do the math. And in a way, we do have to look at the numbers. At least we have to look at their symbolic meaning. The number 7 symbolizes completeness, while the number 70 signifies perfect spiritual order and power. So Jesus is saying here that it isn't good enough to just forgive or pretend to forgive, but we must forgive completely. In other words, there should be no limit to our forgiveness. This is called forgiving others through clenched teeth. And some of us have been here. He's saying, "I said okay, so it's okay. I forgive you." That kind of forgiveness really doesn't work. Why did Jesus believe that the practice of forgiveness was so essential? Well, it has been said by many, it's an oft-repeated quote, that forgiveness is the gate to the kingdom of heaven. And of course, we know that heaven is within. Jim Rosemurgy says there's only one reason that we do not experience the kingdom of heaven, and it is simple. We hold ill feelings toward ourselves or another human being. If God is love, pure and unconditional, and we are created in the image of God, then we too are love. God is always true to God's nature, and we must be true to ours. When our hearts become hardened, it's our hardened hearts that lock that gate, creating a barrier to the love of God that is really always there. And who do you think is the first person we ought to forgive? What do you think? You're right. You all got it. Ourselves. That's exactly right. Forgive yourself first. You know, it's been said that the practice of forgiveness is sort of like peeling away the layers of an onion. And I don't know about you, but I don't like to peel onions. I think it's a little difficult. Plus, sometimes it makes you cry, right? But that outer layer might represent self-forgiveness. It's the first that has to go, and sometimes it is the hardest to peel. And personally, I don't think that we can ever truly forgive others as long as we hold unforgiveness for ourselves. Also, when I do harbor resentment and anger towards someone else, who does it hurt? Does it hurt the person? It only hurts me, right? We all are familiar with that famous quote, harboring unforgiveness is like taking poison and hoping the other person dies. It just doesn't work that way. Butterworth says, yes, we might be entitled to our disappointment and our anger at another's wrongdoing, but then we also might be entitled to our stomach ulcers, nervous tension, and high blood pressure that can result. Unresolved hurt can really turn to hatred, wreaking a corresponding amount of destruction in our own bodies and souls. We cannot afford to let the unforgiven live rent-free in our heads. We either have to raise the rent or bless that person out of our lives. There's a story that I think I've told before about a rabbi who survived the Holocaust. And before coming to America, he said, I had to forgive Adolf Hitler. I did not want to bring Hitler inside me to my new home. And this wise man knew that to forgive is to set a prisoner free, and that prisoner is ourself. So in the end, although Butterworth called this chapter How God Forgives, it is really we and not God who need to practice forgiveness. God sees only our divinity, our good, and he loves all humankind regardless and without reservation. It is we who have judged others as well as ourselves. We are on this earth to serve as beautiful expressions of God's love and light. But we have to awaken to the power within to behold the Christ in ourselves and others in order to turn on that light. And so let's take a moment now just to affirm our God, what the nature of our God, not the Old Testament God of punishment, but the God of love. There is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.